The frog in the window will sing for you. The frog in the window will smile for you with his straw hat and his cane. And you know that you will not be the same, 'cause the frog in the window will dance for you. He'll tap out the rhythm in his bright red shoes. And if you ask why this is done, he'll say you're real when you will not be.
You are listening to In the Window with DJ Frogs on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting round the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives and more.
Photograph of me and my son Ted. That's me cousin with his hanky on his head. We booked in at our hotel just after two and met a family from Bradford that we knew. Who's a nurse, and I've had a bit of bother laying turf. It's life, not books, that taught me all I've learned. Whoop, in the oven, my rice pudding's getting burnt. Here, have you seen the new attachment on me drill? I must have the cat put down, 'cause he's ill.
Hey, neighbour!
Fighting half of the brain pipe. I'm a painted blue. Fighting half of the brain pipe.
Here comes the spoon.
My pink heart of the brain pipe separates me from the incredibly fascinating story of your life and every day-to-day event in all its minute and tedious attention to detail. And was it a Thursday or a Wednesday or... Oh, no, it wasn't, so who cares anyway, because I do not sew normal. If you're normal, I intend to be a freak for the rest of my life. And I shall baffle you with cabbages and rhinoceroses in the kitchen in sets and quotations. From Now We Are Six through the mouthpiece of Lord Snoopy's giant poisoned electric head.
So
that was the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band and My Pink Half of the Drainpipe. I was sat on my lily pad and I thought, I know what this show needs.
Some listeners?
Decent DJ.
New set of dentures.
Proper microphone.
No, bagpipes.
Hello,
That was High Road to Castle Dangerous by this week's featured artist, Cyberpipes. And here's Angry Haggis. Angry Haggis. More from Cyberpipes later. Now over to Uncle Buffo.
Here's part three of An Evening with Quinch and Crisp.
Now I see that you don't really believe in Mrs. Perron. But the Argentinians did. So much so that when she died they petitioned the Pope to make her a saint. His Holiness declined. But if he'd consented, what a triumph for style that would have been. A double fox stole, ankle strap shoes, and eternal life. Nobody's ever had that. But if you feel that all this preaching and teaching, that they're insufficiently physical to embody your idea of yourself, then they're sport. Did you know that Muhammad Ali said, "The boxing was only to bring me to the people"? Think of that. All that diet, all that abstinence, all that downright suffering were only to raise him to a level from which he could still further extend his mammoth lifestyle. And if you think he hasn't done so, remember this. The fight before the final triumph was never once referred to as the contest that unknown gentleman won. It was always regarded as the fight that Muhammad Ali lost. So now we realize that having a lifestyle doesn't even depend on doing things right. But if you feel that you'll never get up early enough in the morning, even to be an indifferent sportsman, all is still not lost. Because the career which will give you the most direct route to self-fulfillment is the stage. And nowadays you don't even have to go onto the stage, because all professions whatsoever are also the career of acting. This is because television has become inextricably woven into our lives. No politician can hope to win votes unless he looks well on television. And in England, we have Sunday programmes which make you feel that no bishop is ever going to bless any part of the congregation which doesn't happen to be kneeling under the arc lights. And we have medical programs which make you fear that no surgeon is going to bother to cut out of your middle anything he doesn't think worth showing to the television cameras. And you must also remember, when you think about the stage, that the journey made by an actress from anonymity to stardom is the path that all of you must tread in one context or another. In the beginning of her career, an actress plays a great number of very different parts. Anything she can get, actually. And at that stage, she says that what she enjoys is the variety. Later on, it's noticeable that she plays fewer, more closely related parts. Now, this is like attacking your identity Red Indian fashion. The circles of experimentation get smaller and smaller until you arrive at the center. In the second half of her career, an actress says that what she likes is the opportunity to study character in depth. She means her own. Because finally, with luck, she finds the one part which fits in every detail, her dream of herself. After many long, dark years, Betty Davis was finally given the part of Regina in The Little Foxes, and this gave her the chance to say, "Very well then, die." And we could see from the glaring eyes and the mouth worn upside down, that's what she'd been waiting to say since 1936. Now, once an actress has found her ideal part, from that moment onward, she never looks forward. She's given up the profession of acting, and she has entered the profession of being. And this, as I see it, is where all of you, in the end, belong. Are you still with me? Do you understand this, are you? Good. Because there is a very special glow which surrounds people who've succeeded in synthesizing their professional and their personal lives. Joan Crawford appeared in any number of movies in which she rose from rags to riches. And in real life, she finally married Mr. Pepsi Cola. And she had all the luck in the world because he died. This meant that she herself could enter the boardroom of that vast worldwide empire, where presumably she said, "Who told you to read the minutes?" just as she'd done in all her movies. I saw Joan Crawford at the National Film Theatre. A car as long as the Thames drew up. And from it stepped those two now famous children. They stood in the lobby looking bewildered. And no wonder, for after about 3 minutes, Miss Crawford came out of the same car and kissed the children as though she hadn't seen them for months. And I had gone up a few steps in order to have a really good view. And for a second, she saw me from those great alligator's eyes. It felt as though my image were being burned on the wall behind me. She was radioactive with belief in herself. And not only will having a lifestyle bestow upon you this massive self-confidence, but it will improve the texture of the entire world through which you move. I've been told that we live in a sex-ridden society. I would have said that we lived in a world corroded with envy. This I have no difficulty in substantiating. When I turn on my television set, what does it show me? Someone stomping through the streets, screeching for equal pay, equal opportunity. Equal is a dead word. Never take as your object in life the desire to be anybody's equal. Once you have entered the profession of being, you have become a professor of a subject on which you are the only living authority. What other people do with their life, with their style, will not matter. In fact, every morning you should say to yourselves, preferably aloud, "Other people are a mistake." No, I withdraw that remark. It might be thought sweeping. Say to yourself, "Concern with other people is a mistake." Now, I know this is not what most people teach you, but I am trying to spare you the traditional scramble for mutual self-sacrifice. Altruism is a debilitating, fragmenting process. But the constant watchover and the perfection of your idea of yourself and the presentation of it, gift-wrapped, to others, that is a unifying and invigorating way of life, and it carries with it a built-in invitation to the party at the end of the world. That glittering function at which everybody will be speaking and nobody will be listening. And if you're armed with your style, you will be able to run toward that happy hubbub without the faintest fear that you may be out of your depth. Without the faintest doubt but that you will shine. And more important than any of this, the burdens of your sorrowful and angry freedom. These problems of who to be and where to go and even what to think, they will fall away from you forever. Now, Andy Warhol is said to be famous chiefly for being famous. And if this is so, it suggests that he will have something to say about lifestyle. And apparently, he has. At least I have been told that he has promised to each of us a quarter of an hour of fame before we die. Now, all I am trying to do here this evening is to place into the hands of anybody who wishes to receive it the philosophy and the techniques by means of which he will be able to augment that moment of glory so that it becomes a whole long lifetime. Now I see that we've been rattling on too long. What we usually do now is have a pause and a good cry. And in your programs you will see bits of paper on which you can write questions which will be handed to me when we come back. I only want to say the words you wish to hear. Thank you. This is the frightening half of the program. At what point in your life did you recognize the need to develop your personal lifestyle? Did it evolve from a single event? No, indeed. I think that because I was an outsider from the very beginning, I was compelled to take an external view of my life. I don't ever remember a time when I was not being laughed at, either by my brothers and my sister when I was a child, by the people with whom I was at school, as you can well imagine, and by the people with whom I first worked when I went out into the world. And I was constantly asking myself, well, what is it that causes all this comment? Why is it that everything I do is a subject of discussion? And I realized after a while that it was my inability to refrain from adding my entire body, my gestures, my face, whatever it was I was saying. Now, this matters less probably here than it does in England. There, the higher up the class system you climb, the smaller the gestures are. And by the time you get to Eton, there are no gestures at all. An Englishman says in exactly the same way and with exactly the same look on his face the words, "How awfully decent to see you," as he does when he says, "You won't be staying long, will you?" So, of course, to see me standing in front of them, waving my arms and rolling my eyes and twisting this way and that, caused them to say, usually, that I was doing it to annoy them. But the time comes for everybody when he has to do deliberately what he used to do by mistake. This is the only way on which you can get the joke onto your own terms. And as soon as I'd realized this fully, which I would say was not until I was 20, 21, 22, I started to do this. I started to make it clear to the world that I knew what it was they were laughing at. And this made my life already much easier to bear. It lessened the tension between me and other people. And this, I think, is the beginning of your style, is when you take an external view of yourself and try to find some way of presenting it to the world. When I use the word style, it means an idiom arising spontaneously from the personality, but deliberately maintained.
Do you understand that? Good. What is your opinion of New York taxis and taxi cab drivers? Well, the national style of America is immediacy. And this you wouldn't notice if you've ever been anywhere else. If people wish to speak to me in England, there's a whole little ritual that they have to go through first. And it begins with the clearing of the throat and the looking at the ground and the saying of remarks like, of course, I've never done this before, but I was wondering whether, no, I shouldn't really ask you. And they can keep this up for minutes. But Americans stand beside you waiting for the traffic lights to change and they say, saw you on the telly. And it's as though they'd known you all their lives. And the immediacy is at its greatest when you're with taxi drivers. And at first I was surprised at this, but of course there's really no cause for astonishment whatsoever. If you have driving skills and you don't like people, you get a job driving one of those trucks from one end of America to the other. You never speak to anybody. You never meet anybody except the hitchhikers, whom you ravish and whose bodies you fling out into the hedge. But if you have driving skills and you do like people, you get a taxi. Who will you meet? The rich, the famous, and the desperate. What a wonderful diet. And when I was in a taxi in Los Angeles, the driver stopped the cab and said, I've got to ask you this. What do you do for a living? And I said, I'm in the profession of being. And he said, I do a bit of that in my spare time. The teleplay of your book conveyed your kindness as much as your humour and intelligence. Thank you. These qualities are equally in evidence this evening. What is your opinion of that television show? I think it differed from the book in the way in which it should differ. It is a play. And it required that in an hour and a half, well, an hour and a half with dog food, that's an hour and 20 minutes. The whole of somebody's life between the age of 6 and 60 should pass before your eyes. So it had to find dramatic points that it could reach and from which it could move on. So it is sharper, clearer, more dramatic than the book, because in a book you can ramble on. But I should say at once that no credit is due to me for the excellence of the program. The praise belongs to Mr. Gold, who directed it, to Mr. Mackey, who wrote it, and to Mr. Hurt, who became my representative on earth. I am only the raw material from which such programs are made. They kept saying to me, is it like it was? And I said, I want what Thames Television wants. They were making a movie in which the main character spends his whole time saying, very well, just as you wish, whatever you say. But when they turned to me and asked me questions, they didn't seem to know I was going to say the same thing. And when the options was bought by Mr. Mackey, he intended originally to make it into a movie. And, of course, if this had been done, it would have been nice, because we would have been speaking in thousands instead of in hundreds of pounds. And, indeed, I need never have got out of bed again. But there has turned out to be an advantage in the fact that it was made for television. If it had been a movie, it would have been advertised as having a homosexual theme, and nobody would have seen it except gay men, oh, and liberals wishing to be seen going into and coming out of the cinema. But it was seen, like all television, by default. In England, there are very few channels, so you're always switching to see what is happening. And one can imagine a woman standing in her kitchen and calling back to her husband, "What's on the telly now?" And when he says, "The Queers," she says, "What's on the other side?" And he says, "The News." And she says, "Oh, go back to where you were." And this is the spirit in which the movie was seen in England. So that it did in the end reach a great many more people than it would have otherwise. In 70 years, you have seen a lot of stage and screen stars. What star in the past would you say had the greatest style? Oh, I think undoubtedly the greatest star I ever saw was Tallulah Bankhead. Undoubtedly. And I once saw a thriller in which, when the curtain went up, there was a corpse on the stage. But as it was her first entrance, the applause was so great that she stepped over the corpse, came down to the footlights, and said, "Thank you, darling." Then she went back over the corpse and said, "Ah!" How do you keep the dust from your room off your black velvet suit? I forgot to mention that you do have to jump in the air when you put on your trousers. But you will be surprised, as the dust accumulates, it does not lie on the surfaces you use most. And it does not lie in the path between the door and the fire, or the door and the stove. It's like snow. It drifts into the corners of the room. Do you ever take a political position beyond pure individualism? I don't really believe in politics. Politics is the art of making the inevitable appear to be a matter of wise human choice. So I don't think any of us need take it seriously in any way. Are we agreed about that? Have you appeared in other dramatic productions? What are you doing after the show? That means you think of this as a dramatic production. When the manager of the theatre where I was playing in London was asked why I was occupying a stage without an equity card, he replied, "Mr. Crisp is not acting, he's very sincere." I have been in a movie that it would be considered polite to call experimental, and it was a movie about Hamlet. And I spoke some of the lines of Polonius, and I unearthed a fact which no actor has ever mentioned, If you play a minor part in an Elizabethan drama, you say the words, "Milord," every sentence. You're put to the utmost effort to try and find different notes on which to place these words. Do you know me, Milord? You are a fishmonger, not I, Milord. And you carry on like this all the time. No one ever mentioned this to me before. Dear heart, how to die with style. Yes, this is one of the great problems. Once you've decided you're a stylist, you must keep in mind the ultimate horizon. You must have a way of ending it on your own terms. And of course, the easiest way to do this is to commit suicide. Suicide is the style in death. Otherwise, you will be left lying on an iron bedstead in a rented room with people standing round saying, "He can't last much longer." Now, people have gladly thrown away their lives, often, but very few people have thrown away their style. Mexico used to be ruled by a man called Mr. Villa. And as you know, in Mexico, there is a revolution every Saturday afternoon. And on one such occasion, Mr. Villa was riding through the narrow streets of a Mexican village, and he was shot. And he fell into a greengrocer's window, and he lay among the artichokes. And one of his henchmen rushed up to him to see if he could be of any help. And Mr. Villa did not say, "Save me." He did not even say, "Help me." He said, "Don't let it end like this. Say I said something." "You seem a lot like Oscar Wilde. What is of your opinion of him and his style?" Well, I worry about Mr. Wilde. He said, "In matters of great importance, it is not sincerity that matters, but style." Now, to me, they're the same thing. Style isn't a lot of dandyism. It isn't a lot of flourishes encrusted upon your public image. It's a way of stripping yourself of everything except your true self. So you can only judge the style by the content, and you only reach the content through the style. As far as I'm concerned, people are always saying to me, "All you want is to be noticed." It isn't enough. I want to be recognized. My appearance is simply a leaflet thrust into the hands of astonished bystanders. And this is, I think, the reason why Mr. Wilde fell apart. When he came out of jail, and he'd only been there 2 years, he fell apart completely and spent the rest of his life in a drunken stupor in Paris. I've known people who were in prison twice as long without writing any of that bad verse. And when they came out, they went on with their lives. Shaken, but they went on with their lives. But Mr. Wilde must have accepted the judgment passed upon him by society, or else he would not have been crushed by it. And one is left absolutely dazed by this discrepancy of the way he saw himself and the way almost anyone else would see him. First of all, there was no need for him to bring a case against Mr. Queensberry. Secondly, he could have evaded the case against himself and was advised to do so by his friends. Thirdly, when in court and the case going against him, he was still making pert replies. And fourthly, he dragged Plato into this sordid case. Plato is only, as you know, a spinster's alibi. And he was mentioning the love that dare not speak its name. How can love be used in a case in which already the names of dozens of young men have been read out, that Mr. Wilde only met by Braille? He met them. He saw them in darkened rooms in Oxford, where the curtains were never drawn. He had no idea of just how sordid his life seemed to the rest of the world. He lived in a dream. Now, this to me is the opposite of style, in which you come to terms with your possibilities and also with your limitations. What are your feelings on psychic phenomena? I have enough difficulty coping with what I really see and feel and understand. I have been living with someone for a number of years. I would like to be alone and on my own. Have tried everything to get out of the relationship without success. How do I get rid of this person? Shoot him.
You're listening to DJ Frog's In the Window with Uncle Buffo's Comedy Spot on Spirit Plants Radio. Broadcasting round the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives and more.
Thank you, Uncle Buffo. And now three more tracks from Cyberpipes. First, Dyke Island.
Memories stray.
Next from Cyberpipes is Very Drunken Sailor. Last track now from Cyberpipes, Auld Lang Syne.
Yeah.
Here's the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band again, and 12 Mustachioed Daughters.
Mustachio daughters running in a field of fat. The full moon high, the mandrake screams, please come to our sabbat. The changing children shiver round the fire, their mothers dance with strangely painted faces that smile but never laugh. The crow peck gibbet's victim swings broken in his cage, his hands cut down to make a crown to wear as our homage. Magic ring, soft figures fastly rush, and wolves flight things and toads with wings whisper wetly, come with us. Fresh plucked eye of a favorite cat, pulped and mixed with a white hen's fat, a lapwing's wing and lion's gall.
And belladonna to make your eye
like a beast's. To anoint the body and make it shine.
To drink and make thyself divine.
To choose another's form and make it thine. And now they gibber blasphemy and fill the fetid air with ancient lies and leprous cries. This night he will be there. A madness has the mouths gaped wide as one they sway and moan, and every brutish face is turned to see our God King's throne.
Two more tracks from Bonzo's to finish with, Cool Britannia and Karma Sutra.
Cool Britannia, Britannia, you are cool, take a trip. Britain's ever, ever, ever shall be hip, 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 hip.